This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, November 28th, 2012. Talking tonight about current Jewish questions with the subject being substance abuse. So first want to just lay a few ground rules here about what we mean in terms of substance abuse and halacha. You could probably imagine that they didn't have a lot of hardcore drugs in the time of the Gemara. So the main things that we're going to be focusing on are at least some types of drugs, which are mentioned, or at least in a general concept, and alcohol, which they also did have. And we're going to focus on, some Jewish perspective of this. So we're not going to talk about anything involving legalization, and regardless of what halacha may or may not have to say or how we can justify certain things, let me just state at the beginning, if you're in a place where it is illegal to do certain drugs, don't do them. Even if your state just recognized it as such, federal law in America is that it's no good. But let's say you decide to move to Amsterdam, where the laws are a lot less lax. So the halachot still apply. And there's some really fascinating questions here, because as we're going to see, some of the logic that people will apply to one type of illicit drug can be applied to lots of other things. And there's a certain degree of selectivity at stake here. So now without further ado, let's get started and ignore the bad joke at the top, the source sheet is a line I had at Twitter a couple of years ago. I support the use of medical marijuana, but only for chronic conditions, which is just really a bad joke. But what was funnier about it is that it actually sparked like a real discussion. And it was like, oh, do you mean from a Jewish perspective? You mean from a halachic perspective? Like, why would a chronic condition matter? I'm like, no, chronic is actually slang for pot. And then the conversation still went on going. So I actually kind of felt bad about deflating. It's like, well, sparked an interesting conversation, but it's all based on a really bad joke. Anyway, so let's start off with, just by way of introduction, a couple of sources of substance use, because there is a significant distinction here between use and abuse, right? So let's start with something simple. Take us off. This is Gemara Gittin 70a.
Sure. There are 8 things which in large quantities are harmful, but in small quantities are beneficial, namely traveling, the way of the world, wealth, work, wine, sleep, hot baths, and bloodletting.
All right, so the main thing that we'd focus on here is wine. And this is just one, and here the Gemara says, wine in a small quantity is good. Wine in a large quantity is bad. Not unlike what you'd find many doctors say today, right? The point is, there's something intrinsically wrong with wine. There are, dozens somewhat other sources about how great wine is. It serves an integral role in Jewish services, such as Kiddush, pretty big deal for wine. Pesach, pretty big deal. We're also not going to talk about Purim. There's a separate class I have on that, on what are the laws of drinking on Purim, whether or not it means to get as drunk. I argue that it doesn't mean to get as drunk as people say you have to, but clearly there's some part about, hey, you're supposed to drink at least some part on Purim. So it's not something that's intrinsically problematic. It's just doing so in excess, right? So, let's just, I just want to give one source here about the problem isn't with wine per se. I mean, it's not the actual entity. And let's look at one on drugs here, Sanhedrin 43a.
Okay, so Rav Chaya bar Ashi Dikton in Rav Chista's name?
Yes.
Okay. When one is led out to its execution, he is given a goblet of wine containing a grain of frankincense in order to benumb his senses. For it is written, give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto the bitter insult.
So here, you're giving, when someone's about to get killed, Jewish capital punishment, you give him something beforehand to sort of, dull it, almost, it's, I would say, anesthesia. But kind of like that. I mean, when, before you give, I don't believe, what's, with lethal injection, is there like an anesthetic before you actually get the poison?
I don't know. I mean, lethal,
it doesn't hurt, though, right?
I was under the impression
allegedly,
lethal injection was somewhat,
I've never gone through it.
No. I mean, it doesn't... From like anything you see about it, doesn't really appear as though the person is in great pain.
Well, we do see, here a very, simple source that says, gives an example of drug use that seems to be okay. And here you may say, well, this is for medicinal purposes, which means the bad joke that I had up there isn't entirely wrong. right? So it's not so much right off the bat. There are seem to be some appropriate uses for drugs, and there seem to be some appropriate uses for wine. Right, just a very simple thesis that, you know, also need to get out the introduction and just need to give one or two sources to explain that, but things that we understand. There are a bunch of the English sources here with the contemporary approaches, and I want to go contemporary before we look at the primary sources, because this reflects a lot of what Orthodox Jews had been saying. These come from a book, the bibliography is in the back of the source sheets, called Judaism and Drugs, edited by Leo Landman, that was published in 1973, and it's got several very well-written articles on the subject. And some really cute anachronisms. Like, there's one line there someone says about people were spending $30 a day on heroin. And I'm like, really? $30 on it? And even had a footnote there's like, even by now, like, this was for a report a few years earlier, and by now it should have been, you know, raised. Like, still, $30 a day.
$30 whole.
Yeah. There was also an introduction and a brief article by former Governor Rockefeller, whom you may recall, or not know, was responsible for the Rockefeller laws, really strict laws of drug enforcement, penalties for drug violations in New York. Anyway, so one article that was there is by Rabbi Nathan Drazen, who has a very interesting question that we'll only touch on briefly. And that is, it's in an article called Halachic Attitudes and Conclusions to the Drug Problem and Its Relationship to Cigarette Smoking. Right, which is a fair question. I mean, when you talk about substance abuse, I mean, the thing is mostly about drugs. Technically, yes, tobacco is a drug, yet people seem halachically more concerned with the, I would say, illicit drugs than the licit. Oh, that's a weird word for it. But things that we are not as accustomed to seeing around here is going to say that explicitly. He asks, why indeed have the great halachic authorities of our generation been silent concerning the prohibitions of Jewish law in regard to cigarette smoking? The author has learned from at least two such scholars that they rely on the Talmudic principle that states, quote, since the multitude are accustomed to it, a practice that may have some peril in it, the Lord preserveth the simple. The context here involves, if I'm remembering correctly, like bloodletting on Wednesdays. You'd have to see the Gemara. It's a strange one. But the point is, there's something that seems to be, something that seems to be a matter at risk, but a lot of people are doing it. In other words, divine mercy will protect the simple from harm when they follow the custom of the many. Surely this principle may not be applied to the use of all may not at all be applied to the use of drugs, for in that case the descriptive phrase, since the multitude are accustomed to it, does not apply, especially so among Jews. So Rabbi Nathan Drazen has argued here basically as well, since you've got this Gemara that says, yeah, even though it's no good but everyone's doing it, God's going to protect the simple. But that doesn't apply to harder stuff because not as many people are doing it.
But I mean, I would still argue that the minority of people smoke.
That is a wonderful... Well, first of all, I don't know what people did in the 70s.
Fair enough.
Right? More people probably smoked in the 70s than they do... Well, I shouldn't say more people, because then you have a demographic range. I would assume it was a lot more common than it is today. You've had a lot of anti-smoking education and legislation since 1973.
For sure, yeah.
So that would be one factor. But you do raise an interesting point. So today, I mean, assuming, you know, his report is correct... and this is, in fact, the reason that maybe today it should be prohibited. On the other hand, let's say today's standards of smoking so prevalent enough, should marijuana get legalized, or again, you happen to be in Amsterdam, well, actually, no, in Amsterdam it's legal. I've never been to Amsterdam. Do you know how many people smoke in Amsterdam, like pot, by any chance?
If a lot of people do it among...
Yeah, I mean, I know it's legal, but does that mean it's popular?
I would imagine so.
I don't think more so than like other places in Europe.
Which would all be more than America.
Might be.
Interesting. I haven't actually done a poll. At any rate, it's an interesting spin on this, because it's almost like, you know, one of the issues that comes up and people describe about the drug culture is that this feeling of solidarity, and yet his argument is, well, it's mutter if everyone else does it.
Yeah.
Which is a strange thing to say when you put those two things together. At any rate, it's something which I just wanted to touch on briefly, at least one argument for, you know, drug use and being bad, or at least worse than smoking, why you don't hear that much about it. Here's a big source, which is, this is published in the book, Judaism and Drugs, on page 29 and 30. It doesn't actually give a year for it or any other publishing information. This is an open letter to the Jewish community from the National Conference of Synagogue Youth, NCSY. And it says, we the undersigned, like most teenagers, have faced the serious issue, it should be faced, I think. It's hard, the language is weird, I try to copy as much as I could. Face the serious issues of drugs and drug use. As members of an Orthodox youth group, we feel that our decision must reckon with the traditions of Judaism and with the specific demands of halakha. Because of the controversial nature of the problem, especially the question of marijuana, we have this past week consulted with some of the greatest halakhic authority of our time. Here they are. So one is Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, Dean of Hebrew Theological College. Two, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Dean of Yeshiva Tveret Yerushalayim, Chairman of Council of Torah Authorities. And three, Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobovitz, Chief Rabbi of the British Commonwealth, author of Jewish Medical Ethics. Their unanimous decision was that the use of marijuana constitutes a violation of basic Jewish law. They have studied the text of their decision and understand their condemnation based on the following principles. What? Being involved with marijuana is a violation of the sacredness of human potentiality. Man is created in the image of God, must constantly walk in the image of his creator. Just as the God of the universe is alive, active, and creative, so must be the world of man. Marijuana leads a person to withdrawal, passivity, laziness, concentration becomes difficult, the study of Torah and fulfillment of mitzvot burdensome. Such a person divests himself of his unique calling to be a real man in the image of God, and in the nakedness stalks the earth in search of the tree of sensuality to avoid and escape this world of reality. Marijuana, its culture and climate, is so far removed from the Torah's call to holiness. 2. When he uses marijuana, violates Numbers 15:39, which I have as a footnote at the bottom, is lo tatur acharei levalchem yacharei nechem asher etzem zonim achareyam. Not going after your own heart and your own eyes after which ye stray. Right? And because of he's addicted to sensuousness, he places himself in a position where destruction of free will and degradation of his inner personality is imminent. Such a person slowly loses his options and choices and the mechanisms of his decision-making powers. Judaism teaches the only difference between man and animal is that man can think, argue, foresee, conclude, and reverse himself. Marijuana helps diminish that distinction and makes man closely relate to the ape. More closely related to the ape. Finally, C, it is also a violation of Deuteronomy 22:8, which stresses the obligation on man to zealously protect his body from anything that may be harmful and injurious. The fact that it is now harmful for a person does not preclude, the chance that it may one day be. A man who does not put up a fence around his roof is in violation of biblical mandate, irrespective of whether some had fallen off his roof or not. A biblical verse so concerned about the loss of limb would be so much more concerned about the possible loss of mind and soul as well. We therefore publicly commit ourselves to the halakhic view that drugs are an irrelevant digression from the basic text of a purposeful Jewish life. Now, one, this is incredibly eloquent for, you know, synagogue youth. Mm-hmm. In NCSY, you know, like the senior reason or high school kids. Now, maybe the educational level has declined, but wow, this is, you'd be hard-pressed to find college kids who could write this way. Mm-hmm. Two, they're asking, you know, for their day, really some of the biggest heavy hitters around in terms of halacha that they would have had access to, which is pretty impressive, right? So first, let's, you know, go through the three core arguments that are given here. One, the section A about the violation of the sacredness of human potentiality. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the first thing that came to me was like what we were discussing before, how, you know, on Purim, I know you said that, you know, a matter of how drunk you're supposed to get, but okay, I mean, I would think that getting drunk would be the exact same problem, and yet... I don't know. It would seem mm-hmm. that the Torah is kind of okay with that on certain occasions.
Right. So you're saying here that a lot of these issues, you know, could very well be applied to other drugs like getting drunk, like alcohol in terms of getting drunk, not necessarily marijuana. So why would that be a distinction?
Right.
And in terms of the substance of the arguments, are you okay with this in terms of this being a reason about the withdrawal passivity and stuff?
Well, I mean, not comparing it to other things, it certainly seems logical enough.
All right. So you're fine with the argument, just that it can be applied more broadly than just drugs. Any thoughts?
I'm not too fond of the argument.
Not too fond? No, why not?
Because, like you said, I mean, you know, there's lots of things that can cause, you know, what they talk about, which is withdrawal, obsessivity, laziness, and whatnot. Like you said, alcohol, right? Or mm-hmm. other things that aren't forbidden, right? Or
how about watching TV?
Or yoga, right?
Yoga does not really lead to laziness. I mean, concentration. Watching TV really does. Well, it depends what you watch.
But yoga puts you in an altered state.
Yeah, but not in the same sense, though. I mean, the ones I know that do yoga, it's not like a removal type of thing. It's actually a way to engage in the world. That's why I give the, you know, TV one, because that's a lot more, you know, mind-numbing, especially, you know, one of the reasons, I mean, I know this from personal experience. It's the reason why I don't own a TV. Like, when I was younger, I stopped watching football on Sundays because after I watched a football game, my brain was jelly. So after I watched the 1 o'clock game, the only thing I could do was watch the 4 o'clock game. And then before you know it, you've wasted 9 hours of a day watching football, which is really, really dumb. So I just stopped. But that's why I gave that example in terms of television. But you're both absolutely right. And it could very well be that they would make the same arguments to those other things as well, okay, in theory. All right, what about this next one? In terms of being addicted to sensuousness.
I mean, I don't really know what they mean by addicted to sensuousness, but I would think that B has a lot of similarity to A.
In what sense?
Well, I mean, such a person loses his options and his choices. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like, you know, you're kind of being inhibited. It sounds, again, like alcohol would be applied the same way.
Okay, fair point. Agree, disagree? All right. And the last one about zealously protecting your body from a harm, an injury.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I mean, again, I don't know. I thought about these things and thought about some other things that we already said were more okay. I mean, cigarette smoking just jumped out to me for the list.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly, probably even more harmful, depending on who you ask medically.
True.
To your body.
Yeah, I left out from the source sheet any of the things on the studies of what marijuana can do for you, because that stuff keeps changing. At least I keep getting,
right,
there's new information. The texts I'm cited here are not changing so much. But,
right,
you know, so you want to say that, well, there could be other things that are more harmful, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, yeah, I mean, okay. I mean, that's a fair question. To give a parallel here, multiple people have told me at different points, like in recent, let's say the past 5 years, that I personally have needed to get high. Meaning, mm-hmm, they said, you really need to get high at some, mm-hmm, point. One of them was actually a doctor. And she said, well, I don't want you to smoke it, but you should at least try the pot brownies. Right? Don't ask. I haven't, if you're listening, I have not done drugs. I'm just saying people have wanted me to. But yeah, I mean, if you have a pot brownie, right, you avoid the smoking problem.
Right.
Right? Whereas in which case, the smoking person, like, the smoking's going to damage your lungs, but doing pot once, not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretically possible, in which case, but that doesn't say that, you know, justify that drugs should be okay. It just means that other things should be less okay.
I think there's a lot of, I mean, it depends on how loosely or seriously you take that third point. Because, I mean, anything that may be harmful, I mean, there's a lot, I mean, playing football, just take your, I mean, you could break bones. There's a lot of things, mm-hmm, that could potentially be harmful.
True.
Driving a car. I mean, there's, it really is endless.
In terms of what percentage of risk? Very good point.
Yeah.
All right. So, does anyone have any other issues with just the body of this entire letter? Because in this very book about Judaism and drugs, there's a person, Benny Kraut, who wrote a piece called Perspectives on the Drug Issue that does take issue with the letter that came out. Do you take it?
Sure. While I applaud the initiative of the CSY youth responsible for having taken a contemporary social problem to rabbinic authorities for a sec, I cannot help but feel sorely disappointed with their discussions, that their discussions did not result in a text for this, I don't know how you say it.
PSAC. Which means like the final decision.
Unfortunately, the printed synopsis deals primarily with conclusions, not sophisticated analysis of the issues, and hence serious questions remain unanswered. Clearly, I do not intend to challenge the authority of the PSAC. I do feel, however, that a much more thoroughly analytic presentation of the PSA than that given by the magazine is in order.
All right. They just said, here's what they say. You know, we're summing up what we take, mm-hmm, from it. And that's a really tricky thing to do, because when you've got, you know, great rabbis who are sending you stuff, you want to see stuff in their name, it's a lot more helpful to rabbis or to anyone who wants to discuss. It's like, well, what did they actually say, not what did you interpret them to say? Because remember, they asked three rabbis questions. Were they in the same room at the same time? Probably not. It's quite possible they all reached the same conclusion, all reached for different reasons, and had, you know, more fleshed out arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why this is important is, in order to address the questions that we've been discussing, plus a whole lot more, you need to see, well, what was the real logic behind it,
mm-hmm,
in order to know, could this in theory be applied elsewhere? Mm-hmm. Continue.
The fundamental flaw in the synopsis text of the Psaf is that no distinction is made between the pothead and the occasional or social user.
And I'll explain in the next paragraph. Go ahead.
To the occasional and social user of marijuana, marijuana may be one form of leisure activity with no concomitant anti-rational and hence anti-Jewish implications. One should, therefore, not necessarily impute to this person the desire to deny creativity and rational activity. If one grants the logic of this argument, then it seems to me that this type of marijuana use does not differ in the slightest form from the social drinking of alcohol at weddings and bar mitzvahs, and from the friendly glass of schnapps distributed at special means when a group of people assembles. Perhaps the only difference lies in the greater health hazard of alcohol to the individual, both physically and psychopharmacologically. Psychopharmacologically.
Yeah.
It seems somewhat unjust and even intellectually indefensible to halachically prohibit the social use of marijuana without simultaneously halachically prohibiting the social use of alcohol. If it is assumed that Jews will be careful not to become alcoholics when they drink on occasion, why is it not similarly assumed that Jews will be mindful not to become potheads when they smoke marijuana on occasion?
So not only does he discuss the stuff that we were just, same stuff we were discussing, he throws in something you haven't discussed, which is recreational versus, I mean, you could say that, yes, it's halakhically prohibited to get addicted. I don't know how addictive pot is, but I know enough people have tried it, once or twice, and aren't hooked on it. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and he's making the same argument that we've made here, which is, what's the difference then between alcohol and social drinking? Mm-hmm. Yes, you can argue that if you in fact do, get addicted, you violated something. And the easiest way to not get addicted is you simply, don't do it. But we don't have that same problem with alcohol. We're not concerned that if you start drinking alcohol, you'll become an alcoholic. Why are we concerned that if you start with pot, you'll do other stuff? And I know people write up today about things like gateway drugs, and maybe those are factors, but he's also not saying here that it is, I mean, I don't want to, cite this in the name of Ben Kratz to say they actually did say halakhically it's okay, as much as these are the questions that were not addressed in the letter that NCSY published. Now, maybe they could have been extrapolated from what they had actually sent, but not from what they said in, the rabbis' names. Mm-hmm. Right? That's more of his point there.
What I find interesting about this is that, okay, so I understand wine aside, but I mean, from a religion like Judaism that puts a geder around so many things that can even be seen as almost like a far reach, I would think that a geder around pot in general, mm-hmm. I would think that, in my opinion, like, Judaism would look at pot and say, like, why even put the temptation, even if you're not going to get addicted? I mean, there's just so much, like, you're not allowed to touch money because you might come to spend it, like, so why, on Shabbos, so why wouldn't it be that, you just don't smoke pot because you never know what could happen? I don't know, it just seems like it would be a natural geder to place.
It could be, but consider that, with people in the, at least, civil discussion of legalizing marijuana, try to compare it to alcohol in that respect too. Mm-hmm. And the main counterargument is, drinking alcohol, has been legal for a while. Prohibition was outlawing something that was legal, not only something that was legal, but wine has been part of Jewish, not just Jewish, but so many cultures for so long, mm-hmm. whereas things like pot haven't.
Right.
Right? Cigarettes too. Someone today came out with cigarettes, it would be banned completely. Right? Why isn't it not banned completely? Because it's already so ingrained. Now, it could very well be that sort of pragmatism factors into it because it's so pervasive you can't stop it. Since marijuana is not pervasive, then it's easier to say, well, it's forbidden, mm-hmm. even though the logic should ostensibly apply to the other stuff too. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, in terms of the substance abuse, I divided the rest of the sources into two things. One, based on what we saw, I want to discuss in one section the issue of protecting one's health. That was an important part. And the other is what I call the spiritual/behavioral considerations. Because it seemed that from the NCSY letter, numbers letters B and C seem to be kind of similar. So let's look at these in turn. So first, in terms of protecting one's health, just one source that is important here, Brachot 32b. Now, rabbis taught, it is related that when a certain pious man was praying by the roadside, an officer came by and greeted him, and he did not return his greeting. So he waited for him till he had finished his prayer. When he had finished his prayer, he said to him, "Fool, is it not written in your law, only take heed of yourself and keep thy soul diligently? This is and is also written, take ye therefore good heed unto your souls. When I greeted you, why did you not return my greeting?" And here he's citing the verse that NCSY cited in their letter, "Nishmartem ma'od l'nashotechem." Granted, in context, it means something a little bit else, but here's the Gemara, where it uses those words legitimately here to say, hey, this means you're supposed to guard against, guard your well-being. And the officer is asking, well, how come you didn't answer me when you're not supposed to jeopardize your life? Mm-hmm. Don't have to get into the answer here, but I just wanted to show how these verses are used to demonstrate that we do have an obligation to take care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Could you do the Gemara 91b? Sorry, Skip, you'll go in other opposite order.
No problem. "And surely your blood of your lives will I require." Genesis 9:5. Upon which Rabbi Eliezer remarked that it meant, "I will require your blood if shed by the hands of yourselves."
And this is the source against suicide. Right, you can't. There is, based on this, that it is that God will consider you. And Rambam writes about this too, that if you commit suicide, it is considered a crime. You obviously can't get put to death for suicide. Rambam says that the punishment is mita bidei shamayim, which is also a weird phrase because you're already dead. But Rambam calls it as the same prohibition of hariga. And the context here is discussing, self-injury, and you're not allowed to do that. Now, have people died from, pot use or for other, alcohol abuse and other stuff? Absolutely. Right? And it seems here that certainly would be a problem. We're going out of order here. Reverse order. Take the Gemara in Tanit 22b.
"Our rabbis have taught, when a city is surrounded by hostile gentles or threatened with inundation by the river, or when a ship is foundering in the sea, or when an individual is being pursued by Gentiles or robbers or by an evil spirit, the alarm is sounded, even on the Sabbath. And on account of all these, an individual may afflict himself by fasting." Rabbi Joseph says, "An individual may not afflict himself by fasting, lest thereby he come to need the help of his fellow men, and it may be that they will not have mercy upon him." Rav Judah said, in the name of
meaning he's giving another, he's saying in the name of Rav, another reason for Yossi. Okay.
So Rabbi Yossi's reason is because it is written, and became a living soul, scripture thereby implies. God says, keep alive the soul which I gave you.
So according to this reason, you can't even take on additional fasts because you're harming yourself. And we'll actually get back to this in our Sunday class. I think we'll be doing this same source next, this coming Sunday. Point that I wanted to illustrate here is, fasting, which is normally considered a religious, type of thing, is not something that should be done necessarily on a regular basis if it causes that much affliction, because, it's not even the cause of affliction, but neshama shen taught to be chayav, like, you're supposed to keep yourself alive, right? Vodah Zarah 18a, it was said, within but a few days, Rav Yossi Bar Kisma died, and all the great men of Rome went to his burial and made lamentation for him. On their return, they found Rav Hananya ben Taradion sitting and occupying himself with the Torah, publicly gathering assemblies and keeping a scroll of the law in his bosom. Straight away they took hold of him, wrapped him in the scroll of the law, placed bundles of branches around him, and set them on fire. They then brought tufts of wool which they had soaked in water and placed them over his heart so that he should not expire quickly. His daughter exclaimed, "Father, that I should see you in this state." He replied, "If it were I alone being burnt, it would have been a hard thing to bear. But now that I'm being burning with the scroll of the law, he who will have regard for the plight of Torah will also have regard for my plight." His disciples called out, "Rabbi, what seest thou?" He answered them, "The parchments are being burnt, but the letters are soaring on high." "Open thy mouth," said they, his students, "so that the fire enter into thee." He replied, "Let him who gave my soul take it away, but no one should injure himself." So you have someone being tortured to death, being burnt alive, not taking an active step to hasten his death. All right, and finally, take a last one.
Okay, Rabbi Yehuda, son of Rav Chia, remarked, come and see how the dispensation of mortals is not like that of the Holy One, blessed be he. In the dispensation of mortals, when a man administers a drug to a fellow, it may be beneficial to one limb but injurious to another. But with the Holy One, blessed be he, it is not so. He gave a Torah to Israel, and it is a drug of life for all his body, and it said, and healing to all his flesh.
All right, so, I mean, it's a very nice, you know, midrash here about how great Torah is. The reason why I underline this line, when a man administers a drug to a fellow, it may be beneficial to one limb, but injurious to another. This is something that Rav Tendler used to say in Shir, that the human body is a very, you know, it's a complex organism. Whenever you take one drug, you know, it does one thing, but it sets off something else. Now, here's an interesting part of the discussion. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that was Gemara Eruvin of 54a. 54a about, you know, differences of, you know, regular drugs and, I guess, the drug of Torah. So we had a bunch of sources, right, which showed somewhat definitively, you are not allowed to injure yourself. But yet, we take medication. Mm-hmm. Now, every time you take a medication, you're going to have side effects, are you not? Yeah. All right, let's give one example, chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is an essential treatment for many cancers. Chemotherapy has really bad side effects. Nausea, hair loss. Well, hair loss, I mean, people would rather have hair loss than, say, cancer. But from everything that I've seen and heard, it's not a very pleasant experience. Right? I'm sure you all know people who not only have had side effects, but there are some side effects that are so bad that you have to take another medicine just to counteract the side effects of that first medicine you need to take. Mm-hmm. Right? That's just a fact of all medications. So what do you say? Are you allowed to take drugs? Are those considered causing harm?
I don't know, maybe the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
Kind of a logic. Like, you know, you said, like, for instance, like chemotherapy, you know, it's terrible and obviously it looks absolutely horrific. You're doing to ultimately save your life. I mean, cancer will kill you.
Right. Let's take something that's a little less extreme. Right, because, you know, in a case of life and death, you're allowed to break any law. I mean, you can amputate a limb, right, to save the rest of the body. Now, even Chazal understood that. But let's say it's some other lesser type of thing. Your life isn't at stake, but you're taking a medicine that has a side effect, mm-hmm. right? Now, there's a trade-off there. Life's not in danger, but yet you're taking a drug for it. Seems to be, I mean, no one argues that you can't take medicine because it's going to have side effects and because you're harming yourself, because there's an understanding that you have an affliction. Yes, it causes other problems, but, you know, that's not really considered harm since your overall intent is to get better. Are you not? Okay, then. Now, the reason why that's important is because we need now, especially when we get to the second section, is, you know, that turns the whole thing with marijuana and drug use or even alcohol use, not just to a matter of what you're doing or how much you're doing it, as much as what's your intent. What is the point of why you're doing this? It's, you know, mm-hmm. you know, it's a matter of motivation. Like today, you've got painkillers. Painkillers are very important. So it's very easy to get hooked on painkillers. Right? Does that mean you shouldn't take painkillers lest you become addicted? Haven't heard anyone say that either, mm-hmm. but there seemed to be somehow a good enough reason for it. And that's going to be the, you know, sort of the section that will, we'll keep that in the back of your head. We'll flesh out some of those ideas in this next section here. Let me start this off with a surprisingly eloquent statement by Rabbi Moshe Tendler in the same book of Judaism and Drugs, where he writes, When the momentary enjoyment of a drug-mediated euphoria is fixed as a component of the daily life pattern, we have man in defeat, with the enemy so omnipresent as to preclude any future hope of turning defeat into victory. The injection of an addictive or mind-destroying drug is an act of physical mutilation of those neural pathways that in composite are the psychological basis of human behavior. The motivation for this mutilation is a refusal to accept the burden of the yoke of mitzvot. People know Rabbi Tendler. I've never read him this eloquent. I could disagree with what he says here, but, you know, it's really well. I don't know. I was impressed by it. Anyway, he does seem to be talking about addiction here, right? Now, it seems also that,
Right. At least the addiction part is the man in defeat. But he injected of any addictive or mind-destroying drug, he calls that physical mutilation, not just psychological, which, in a sense, puts it back in the category of the previous section, because he writes about the neural pathways as actually a physical thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not. He says that the motivation for self-mutilation is refusal to accept the burden of the yoke of mitzvot. That's a pretty interesting proposition there. What do you think? Think that's true? Think that's untrue?
I mean, it seems like a bit much. So he's saying that is the purpose, like that is why one would do that, to not accept the burden of the yoke of mitzvot?
Well, it seems that you start off by, because you don't want to accept the yoke of the mitzvot, you instead turn to drugs.
I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree with that. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a number of reasons that people would turn to drugs. I don't think it's all necessarily because they don't want to accept mitzvot.
What do you think?
I don't see how you could disagree with what you just said. Yeah?
No? You agree or disagree?
No, I agree with him. Yeah.
All right. So along those lines, so what would kind of be the Torah's approach to this sort of thing? Take Gemara and Brachot 5a.
Rabbi Levi B'Hama says in the name of Rabbi Simeon B'Lakish, a man should always incite the good impulse in his soul. In the Talmud, the good impulses and evil impulses of a man are personified as two genii.
Yeah, I don't know. It's Yetzer Tov, Yetzer Ra. This is according to the footnote. I don't know why I use genii, like plural of genie, or spirits. It's a Cencino translation. I apologize for that.
Two genii are spirits dwelling in his soul, the one prompting him to do good things and the other one to do wicked things. The meaning of this saying here is that a man has always to make an effort and to fight against the evil instincts, to fight against the evil impulse. For it is written, tremble and sin not. If he subdues it, well and good. If not, let him study the Torah. For it is written, commune with your own heart. If he subdues it, well and good. If not, let him recite the Shema. For it is written, upon your bed. If he subdues it, well and good. If not, let him remind himself of the day of death. For it is written, and be still, Selah.
So this could very well be, I don't recall if every time I quoted this directly, but this would seem to be the alternative. A lot of people struggle with a lot of stuff in their lives. Now, drugs are certainly an answer. You know, obviously people would say not the best answer, but it's, you know, one of the options. Just from this Gemara, it seems, well, you know, you've got temptations, you could do one thing or another, always pick Torah. People who do drugs, even you're doing it just to, you know, feel better. It's like, could be Yetzer Hara is nagging you for it. And even if you're turning to it for, you know, because you have other issues that you just can't deal with, if you can't handle, then it seems that, you know, I think Jewish thing, well, would say, well, look towards the Torah. And it could be, Rav Tendler would argue, that fundamentally when you turn to other places aside from Torah for such solace, you are in fact throwing off the yoke of the mitzvot. I honestly have not spoken to him about this. I only came across it, this passage earlier this week. Anyway, that's, you know, at least one, let's call that the firm approach for now. But moving on, you know, we do find matters of substance abuse itself in the Torah in some way, or at least some of these ideas, or at least the concerns of Rav Tendler, actually mentioned in Gemaras. Gemara Ketubot 8b.
Ula said, and some say, that it was taught in the
Abraita.
10 cups of wine the scholars have instituted to be drunk in the house of the mourner. 3 before the meal in order to open the small bowels. 3 during the meal in order to dissolve the food in the bowels. And 4 after the meal, one corresponding to who feedeth, the first blessing. 1 corresponding to the blessing of the land, second blessing. 1 corresponding to who rebuildeth Jerusalem, third blessing. And 1 corresponding to who is good and doeth good, fourth blessing. They then added unto them another 4 cups, 1 in honor of the officers of the town, and 1 in honor of the leaders of the town, and 1 in honor of the temple, and 1 in honor of Rabban Gamliel. When they began to drink too much and to become intoxicated, they restored the matter to its original state.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be a fun morning place.
Yeah.
Right? But there was a concern. I mean, people were, you know, the legislators, like, you know, yeah, we're going to have 10 cups of wine for benching. Spam, people got drunk. Not a good thing. Right? Because people started getting drunk, they stopped it. Here's another one. This is Gemara and Tanit 25 and 26. 25b to 26a. Once happened, rabbis ordained a feast in. They called. I'm sorry. Cincinnati translated Lud as Lydia. And I'm immediately thinking of the Groucho Marx song of Lydia the Tattooed Lady. If you don't know what that is, look it up. Should they not have recited Hallel first? Abaye and Rava explain this to be because the Hallel is recited only when the appetite is satisfied and the stomach is full. Is that so? Did not Rav Papa on occasion when coming to the synagogue at Abi Kobar, a place in the vicinity of Mechoza, ordain a fast and rain fell before midday? Yet the first recited Hallel and only then after, and only after that the people ate and drank? It is different with the people of Mechoza, because drunkenness is frequent amongst them. Meaning, hence, they cannot be trusted to leave over Hallel unless they had eaten and drunk. This is somewhat critical of the people of Mechoza, who were not... they're generally not reported on as great people. Dr. Yaakov Elman called them the Upper West Side of Babylon, because they just weren't that firm and didn't care much for Halach and the rabbis. But yeah, drunkenness, also not so good. Here's one more. Gemara Yoma 70b.
Why is it wine? Why is it
wine?
Why is wine called Yain and Tirosh? It is called Yain because it brings lamentation into the world, and Tirosh because he who indulges in it becomes poor.
Right? Indulgence. Kol Hamitzar Gebo Naaserash. So they were clearly aware of alcoholism. But they were also aware of other, you know, forms of drug abuse. Here's Psachim 113a.
Rav said to his son Chia, "Do not take drugs, even as medicine, as they are habit forming." Says Rashi.
Right. So that's Rashi's approach. The Gemara just says lo tishti sama, just avoid drugs. And the concern here, right, is if you get accustomed to drugs, you're going to get hooked on the drugs, right? Seems to be a pretty significant issue there. Hariot 10b, another case of substance abuse regarding alcohol. But was he, Lot, not a victim of circumstances, having been under the influence of drink administered by his daughters? It was taught in the name of Rav Yose, the son of Choni, Rav Choni. Why is there a point on the Vav of Uvachum Kuma, is mentioned in connection with the eldest daughter, to indicate that though she did not know when she lay down, he knew when she arose. What, however, could he do when he arose? Surely, what was done could not be undone. Matters might have been different. He should not have drunk again on the following evening. In the story of Lot, according to the Bible, one of his daughters, this was after the destruction of Sodom, thought that they were the only people left on earth, and in order to repopulate the earth, the daughters of Lot had to sleep with Lot. So, what did one do? Got him drunk, had sex with him, eventually had a kid. Same thing happened the next night. So the Gemara says here, well, even if you want to say that first night wasn't really his fault, you don't get drunk a second time. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a recognition here also about even like relapsing or just how badly alcohol can cloud your judgment. Like not only you do it once, but you also go ahead and you do it again. I don't know if you was, flat out alcoholic, but there is, I think, this recognition that, not only about just how bad things like alcohol can do, not recidivism, but in terms of repeating the same mistakes again and just really destroying your judgment. Probably the most stark example of this is the Bein Sorer Umora, the rebellious son. According to the Mishnah, this is the Gemara in Sanhedrin 70a, when does the rebellious son become liable? When he eats a tartamar of meat and drinks half a log, a liquid measure equal to the contents, or space occupied by, 6 eggs, of Italian wine. Italian wine is particularly choice and strong, and drinking such a quantity thereof might lead him to drunkenness and its consequent vices. But this measure of any other inferior wine would neither be so potent nor seductive. So Hanan said, the only purpose for which wine was created was to comfort mourners and requite the wicked. The wicked are thereby rewarded for the little good they do in this world, according to Rashi. For it is written, give strong drink unto him that he is ready to perish, the wicked, and the wine unto those be of heavy hearts. Rabbi Isaac said, what is meant by, look not upon thy wine when it is red, look not upon the wine which rends the face and the wicked of the world and makes them pale with shame the next. Rabbi said, look thou not to the wine kiadam, whatever, for it leads to bloodshed. He translated, when it's red is taken as reflexive of blood. Continuing in this theme, the Gemara in Sanhedrin 72a said, has been taught, Rav Yossi the Galilean said, did the Torah decree that the rebellious son be brought before the Beit Din and stoned merely because he ate a tartamar of meat and drank a log of wine? Normally having, a steak and wine dinner is not a capital offense. But the Torah foresaw his ultimate destiny. For at the end, after dissipating his father's wealth, he would still seek to satisfy his accustomed gluttonous wants, but being unable to do so, go forth and cross roads and rob. Therefore the Torah said, let him die while innocent, let him not die guilty. For the death of the wicked benefits the wicked, and the death of the world of the righteous injures themselves in the world. Sleep and wine of the wicked benefit themselves, and the world of the righteous injure themselves in the world. And gives, you know, feelings with tranquility and scattering. So this is really powerful on a whole bunch of levels here. So one, and I want to focus on, is the Torah foresaw its ultimate destiny. Right? For the Bein Sora Mora, you're not being judged on what you do now, what you've done, but what they think you're going to do. And I think when people have had these discussions, that's a concern in drug use. Meaning, you're not concerned with, like, oh, are you going to take marijuana now, but what is that going to lead to? There is, you know, enough evidence, at least, that, you know, drinking alcohol, at least more people drink alcohol, or let me take a step back, a smaller percentage of those who drink alcohol become alcoholics than I would think the ones who do pot either become addicted to pot or some other drug. That, yeah, okay, that's, I think, a more accurate statement. So that is, I think, an important point here in terms of what are, like, Ezu Chacham Horeh Tanolad, you know, he who is wise can see what's going to happen. And there's another sense here about, you know, why do the wicked benefit themselves in the world? The righteous injure themselves. Meaning, righteous people shouldn't be busy with drinking anyway. But we're left still with our, you know, a lot of our original questions here. We do have support in the rabbinic sources, at least, for, you know, taking care of yourself and for what are going to be the components behind it. But we're still left with a few interesting questions here. Right? So one is the recreational side, like only doing it once when there's no chance. Is taking that chance worth the risk? Well, that depends also on just how badly pot actually messes with your brain. Is it really permanent? Is it not permanent? And in that case, it could very well be halachically subjective that you're not really going to know until after you try it. But given that that's a risk, you can say, well, don't bother trying it. As opposed to something like alcohol, we kind of know the risk. Some people have even said, supporting that first Gemara that we did, that you're supposed to drink like a little bit of wine a day. So that could very well be fine. Where things get even more complicated is for things like medical marijuana, because that's, you know, and medical marijuana is when it's actually licensed by a doctor as some sort of pain medication, right? So if we were in that context, halakhically would seem to be absolutely fine, right? Just like any other painkiller they'd give you would have some side effects, same deal would apply to marijuana. The only issue in America is that marijuana happens to be illegal. But you do have narcotics as controlled substances. After I had oral surgery, I was given a narcotic as a painkiller. Right? Now, not all narcotics are illegal. Right? Not all of them are obtained illegally. There was a prescription. I was on prescription narcotic for like a week or so, and that was it. Right? So that could be one issue. But let's say you're talking in a case where it's not really prescribed. You know, if you're talking about a case of, you know, you just want the high because you want to have that emotion, you know, that physical feeling, well, is that really a problem? There are lots of things that you can get pleasure from in this world. Why would that not be one of it? Meaning, if the concern here is that you might get too much, well, what about if you eat, like, and we just had Thanksgiving, all right? So what if you had a really awesome Thanksgiving dinner and you just really wanted to enjoy it, right? Would you also not say that that logic should have, like, you know, that's could make you lazy for a bit if you've got, after you eat a really great meal, you have to go to sleep, right? Now, again, I'm not comparing in terms of quantifying how much pleasure versus how much laziness or whatnot afterwards. We're talking about like a one-shot deal. People don't do this on a regular basis. You know, let's say pot might fall under the same circumstance, right? And that's if you're doing it recreationally or doing it for fun, to have some sort of physical pleasurable experience, which otherwise are not prohibited by Jewish law. It's not, you know, we're not ascetics. I mean, you did have Jewish aesthetics, but it's not ingrained. I mean, you're supposed to enjoy this world. Pot is a natural substance, right? Grows on trees, well, plant, whatever, right? So you're actually, in fact, enjoying, you know, what God gave you in this world. One question. Another one would be, we spoke about motivations. Not one was the, I mean, the sense of that was a positive motivation. There could also be another motivation where people do pot. Like, there are people who are feeling lost. There are people who get into drugs because, you know, there is a drug culture. It gives you some common bond. In that case, it often is serving not a physical pain as much as an emotional or psychological pain. So you could be using it as, say, an antidepressant. because life is just too painful and you need something for it. Now, I've met no one who said that antidepressants are usser. I don't know anyone who said, well, just because you're depressed, you ought to suck it up and deal and look to the Torah and not take Prozac or whatever. Right? But it would be, say, somewhat of a medical condition. You happen to be self-medicating. Your reason for it, now maybe you could be addicted to it, but there are people who are on drugs because they need to be for the rest of their lives. You could say that that's a type of addiction in a way too, but you're doing it to cure a certain type of pain. Now, you could make that argument halakhically to pot too, given how some people get into it. Now, again, I'm not advocating people do it from, you know, everything that I've seen. I do know people who have done pot, or at least who have said they've done pot, with no averse problems. I do know that there's one rabbi in particular, you can find him on Twitter, at Recovering Rabbi, who does a lot of work with addicts. And he can tell you a lot in a lot more greater detail of horror stories about what drugs actually do to people. So, you know, for that alone, you know, it would be, you know, my own opinion, and this isn't so much a psak as much as, you know, my perspective, is that even if I could come up with halakhic reasons why, if you do it, it's, you know, you could be within the realm of halakha. Like, let's say, baking a pot brownies. Right? Sounds simple, sounds harmless. It seems to me that the inherent risks involved are so bad that it would make a whole lot more sense not to, you know, try in the first place. You know, given the potential cost. Like the fact that, you know, you try it and nothing happens, okay. But that doesn't mean you should go off and, you know, seek such things, because also, like, let's say you try it once, what happens the second time? My understanding is also that drugs, you know, you build up an immunity, and sometimes, again, it depends on the type of drugs. And I've also only used pot for this. For things like, you know, heroin or crack or cocaine, I know people who've done, I think, all of them. But you've got stronger drugs that have a much greater risk for long-term harm, right? In which, I mean, and this, you know, and we're just talking about, like, the drugs itself. We're not talking about cherry needles, even. Yeah, so I would say, you know, avoid it, don't do drugs. The halacha, you know, the halachic applications of, you know, a lot of these sources, I think people have recognized the trouble. I think certain people would, in fact, prohibit cigarette smoking, technically. But I think because it's so pervasive, you know, they probably wouldn't. And I think that, you know, the cultural acceptability is a factor, as, you know, Rabbi... which one was it? Rabbi Drazen reported. You know, there are things that people do today that they probably shouldn't. So if you do need to find your, you know, escapes, try to find something that's a little bit healthier. And, you know, if you have any other, you know, issues, see, like, actual real medical professionals. Even if you live in a country where doing part of this other stuff is permitted. Just my opinion. Any thoughts? Final words?
No.
All right. Well, thanks for coming out. Hope to see you next week.